The headlines this hour. Hamas leader in Gaza says resistance is the only way to liberate the occupied territories as Palestinians mark the 35th anniversary of the creation of the resistance movements. U.S. officials say Washington will soon send a sophisticated Patriot missile system to Ukraine to bolster its air defense against Russian attacks. And more than a million British households sign up to a plan which will pay them return for using less electricity amid warnings about rolling power outages this winter. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The head of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in Gaza says resistance is the only way to liberate the occupied Palestinian lands. In a speech marking the 35th anniversary of the movement's creation, Yahya Sinwar condemned the regime's aggressive policies against Palestinians. He stressed that the resistance front will continue to fight against those atrocities, but called for unity among Palestinians. Sinwar also slammed some Arab nations for normalizing ties with what he called the apartheid regime. The Hamas political bureau chief, Esmael Haniyeh, also spoke on the occasion and emphasized the movement's unwavering support for and commitment to the Palestinian cause. Hamas was established soon after the first Palestinian uprising broke out against the Israeli occupation. The movement has been administrating Gaza since the year 2007, when it scored a surprise parliamentary victory. Every year, Hamas marks the anniversary of its foundation with military parades and rallies. Earlier, our correspondent Ashraf Shannon walked us through the mass rally in Gaza on the 35th anniversary of the formation of the Hamas resistance movement.
Well, since the thousands of people gathered here in this huge area to rally to mark the 35th anniversary of Hamas's establishment, people from all walks of life came here and stressed the adherence of the Palestinians and the resistance factions to the resistance against the Israeli regime. 35 years ago, Hamas was established based on resistance and Islamic values, and the movement continues to garner support and popularity year after year because of its refusal to recognize the Israeli regime and adherence to armed resistance as the key to the liberation of Palestine. What really is clear today that Hamas reiterated the principles of the Palestinian people. That's the right of return for refugees, the liberation of Al-Quds, the sanctity of Al-Quds, and the extreme importance of defending Al-Quds against the desecration by Israeli settlers and soldiers.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called for the swift and serious punishment for the perpetrators behind the assassination of prominent Sunni cleric Molavi Abdul Wahed Righi. In a message, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei expressed deep condolences over the tragic loss of the cleric. He said those who committed the crime were mercenaries in service of the enemies who seek to target the unity of the Iranian nation. Earlier, Iran said it has arrested three Takfiri terrorists behind the killing of the religious figure. According to a senior prosecutor in the southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan, they were detained while trying to flee across the border. The officials said the terrorists, by committing the heinous crime, were hoping to provoke a dispute between Sunni and Shia Muslims in Iran. Righi was abducted at noon on Thursday while leaving a mosque in the city of Khash. The cleric had previously said he was receiving death threats from groups hostile to Iran.
Another attempt to stoke division in Iran by terrorists who would stop at nothing to reach their goal of creating instability. On December 9th, officials in Sistan and Balochistan province said the body of slain Sunni cleric Molavi Abdul Wahed Righi, who was kidnapped a day earlier, has been found. According to police reports, on Thursday, a number of unknown individuals took him away in a car that had no license plate.
He was a good person who always tried to help people. He was my student. He always supported the Islamic Republic. He was a patriotic and religious person. Iran's unity and territorial integrity was very important to him, and he even served in the Iran-Iraq War.
Days before he was kidnapped, he met a delegation representing leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the province. Molavi Abdul Wahid Righi always emphasized on the importance of allegiance to the Islamic Republic. In the province, he was seen as a symbol of unity between Shia and Sunni Muslims.
Sistan and Baluchistan province is among the regions most affected by the recent farm-backed riots in the country. And this recent assassination is an obvious attempt to stoke division. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Russia says U.S. Patriot missile defense system to Ukraine will be a legitimate target of its strikes should Washington deliver them to Kiev. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov issued the warning after media reports quoting unnamed American officials as saying that a plan is being finalized to send the missile systems to Ukraine. Now, they say the decision could be announced as soon as this week. The Patriot is one of the most advanced U.S. air defense systems against aircraft and incoming missiles. The U.S. has recently boosted its air defense support to Ukraine, citing a surge in Russian missile attacks. Washington has so far provided Ukraine with over $19 billion in military assistance since the beginning of the conflict.
Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, European countries have focused their attention on providing support to Kyiv, whether be it financially or militarily. However, Europe's increased concentration on Ukrainian refugees has diverted resources away from other refugee crises around the world. European countries are the largest donors of international aid. In recent years, European nations have been providing 50 billion euros per year to some underdeveloped countries that rely on foreign aid. But since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, the aid embarked for other countries was gradually cut and pumped into the war and the resulting crisis. The European Union has also agreed to add 2.1 billion euros to a fund severely depleted by the military aid for Ukraine in the war against Russia. The so-called European Peace Facility was set up last year to help the EU fund military assistance to its international partners. The fund's original budget of 5.7 billion euros was meant to last until 2027, but has almost completely run dry 10 months into the war in Ukraine. The EU and its member states have so far committed about 8 billion euros of military support to Ukraine against Russia. According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, 80% of the people in need of humanitarian aid live in 20 nations. The huge amount of money splurged on Ukraine and Ukrainian refugees has come at the expense of millions others in dire need of healthcare, education, and food across the globe. According to a new report, over 300 million people, half of them children, are in need of desperate aid in some of the world's poorest and most conflict-ridden regions. They have all been deprioritized following the war in Ukraine. For instance, while half of the Somalian population is facing famine, last year the African country was able to receive 68% of its requested funding after a year. Ukraine, though, received the same amount in a matter of 6 weeks. European countries have exhibited double standards regarding sheltering refugees from Ukraine and other nations, giving priority to the former. For example, Denmark holds a hard-nosed stand on Syrian immigrants, but reversed its strict asylum policy only to host Ukrainian refugees. Or in the UK, the government cut all non-essential aid back in 2020, reducing its official development assistance from 0.7% to 0.5%. The Center for Global Development says the reduced aid was spent on housing Ukrainians in the country.
Directing huge amounts of money to Ukraine has left European countries with very little for development in places like Africa. This comes as human rights and anti-war activists say that Western powers are hell-bent on fanning the flames of war in Ukraine as it helps their arms industries flourish.
Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine in late February, following Kyiv's failure to implement the terms of the Minsk agreements and Moscow's recognition of the breakaway Donetsk and Luhansk. At the time, Russian President Vladimir Putin said one of the goals of what he called a special military operation was to denazify Ukraine. Since the outbreak of the war, Western countries have supplied large consignments of heavy weaponry to Ukraine, with the U.S. topping the chart of supplies despite Russia's repeated warnings that it would only prolong the war. In terms of overall spending on direct military support to Ukraine, the U.S. has committed $18.5 billion, far more than any other country. Germany, the U.K. and Poland have pledged second, third and fourth largest amounts to the war-ravaged country, prompting many to argue that they seek to drag the war. Russian ambassador to the U.S. Anatoly Antonov said last month that Washington sought to prolong the conflict to reap profit from its sale of military equipment and liquefied natural gas to European countries. However, according to reports, as the war intensifies, the arsenals are increasingly depleting, particularly in the U.S. Russian President Vladimir Putin has earlier criticized Western states' policies, warning that they are increasing the risk of a global conflict. Putin also accused the West of exploiting Ukraine and using its people as cannon fodder against Russia. Moscow has repeatedly denounced the West's military support for Ukraine since the war began. The Kremlin says Western countries are only adding fuel to the flames of war, adding that they do not seek to find a solution to end the conflict.
Iran and Russia have signed a memorandum of understanding to develop ties in the field of aerospace industry. For more on that, we are now joined by the spokesman of Iran's space agency, Hossein Dalirian, who joins us from Kish. Hossein Dalirian, we understand, obviously, the Kish air show has taken off there. And this cooperation between Iran and Russia in terms of the aerospace sector really took off when we saw the launch of the Khayyam satellite back in August. And this seems like now it's expanding. Tell us more about this cooperation, if you can.
In the name of God, based on the joint cooperation plan that was designed earlier, Iran and Russia have decided to proceed and expand this cooperation agreement, and there were some negotiations within the framework of Kish talks, and the talks have started since yesterday. And these are intensive talks amongst the space officials of both countries. And after holding experts meetings covering various space areas, the talks were held yesterday. And this afternoon, the head of the space agencies of Iran and Russia, Dr. Salarieh and Mr. Nuri Varisov, they had bilateral talks at senior levels. The talks started in Kish Island. And these talks were constructive and fruitful, and both sides reached concrete results. And eventually this afternoon, an important deal was signed for space cooperation between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Russia. The deal was signed by the space agency officials of both countries. In connection with the details of this agreement, and the signed document, I can refer to a number of topics. I can refer to topics such as agreement for joint manufacturing of satellites, including the designing of survey and telecommunication satellites. In the meantime, based on this document that was signed by both countries, the two countries are obligated to take joint steps for the development of infrastructures and also hold joint training courses. So these will be among the future measures that will be taken by both sides. Based on this important agreement reached today in Kish Island, the expansion of space cooperation will be promoted, and this was signed by the space agency officials of both countries, and this has created a bright prospect for us. So the framework of future cooperation by two countries in this space field was signed by the Iranian and Russian sides. So this was a major step forward with respect to cooperation in the field of space.
If you want to take a look at some of those areas that you talked about in terms of the cooperation, which I understood to be agreement of satellites or joint steps for development of infrastructure, when will this all actually begin, even though agreements were made today, as you mentioned?
The document that was signed today includes initial agreements. It actually delineates and depicts the outline for cooperation. So based on this agreement that was signed today, and we actually released some parts of the document. So it was approved by both sides to consider a short period of time, so that during this period of time, the technical experts from the Russian and Iranian space agencies would hold talks, and within these talks, the details for the implementation of the agreement would be become clear, and grounds would be paid for further cooperation in the areas I mentioned. I believe that the signing of the agreement is of paramount importance, because we can say that a major step has been taken forward for expansion of cooperation in the past.
Okay, very well. Thank you very much for that. Hossein Dalirian, spokesman of the Iranian Space Agency, talking to us there from Kish. Thank you. More than a million British households have signed up to a plan which will pay them in return for using less electricity at peak hours in a bid to help the country prevent blackouts. Under the demand flexibility service, consumers will be paid if they switch off their appliances when the demand is high. Britain's National Grid has said the trial of the scheme shows that it would help households save a total of around £2.8 million. It says the test results indicate that the plan would help the country's national grid balance the electricity network in the winter. The National Grid warned in October that homes could face 3 to 4 rolling power outages this winter unless the country finds a way to meet its energy demands. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Carrie Lake, the Trump-backed Republican candidate for governor of Arizona, has filed a lawsuit asking the court to throw out certified results of a loss to Democrat Katie Hobbs. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. USA Today has covered the story and tells us more. Former candidate for governor Kerry Lake on Friday, 9th of December, filed a lawsuit asking the courts to set aside her electoral loss to Democrat Katie Hobbs and declare her the winner instead. If a judge won't declare her the winner, Kerry Lake wants an order requiring Maricopa County to redo the gubernatorial election. Kerry Lake, a former television news anchor and first-time candidate for office, has signaled for weeks that she would file a legal challenge over the election, which saw her fall 0.7 percentage points, or about 17,000 votes, short of her rival, Katie Hobbs, who is Arizona's Secretary of State. The filing came on Friday, 9th of December, within a five-day window from certification of the election result that is set in Arizona law, and on the same day that several defeated Republican candidates filed their own challengers. Republican Secretary of State candidate Mark Fincham and U.S. House candidate Jeff Zink contested their losses, saying Arizona's election was not full, fair, or secure, and must be nullified. A process that should be sacrosanct oozes impropriety, they said in a joint statement of election contest filed in Maricopa County Superior Court. Our election is the only midterm election in the 50 states with such a comical and tragic outcome. Republican Abe Hamade, who was defeated by Democrat Chris Mays in the race for Attorney General by about 500 votes, also filed a lawsuit that stood in stark contrast to the others, in that it explicitly did not allege fraud or intentional wrongdoing, but sought to eliminate or add votes Hamade claims were improperly counted. The race is headed for a recount. Kerry Lake's 70-page lawsuit includes a laundry list of problems and allegations related to the 8th of November midterm elections, including echoing many claims she has raised in recent weeks over long lines and printer issues created chaos at voting locations. She claims hundreds of thousands of illegal ballots infected the election in Maricopa County, Arizona. The lawsuit also references issues that were raised and repeatedly debunked in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential contest and the subsequent Arizona Senate review of the Maricopa County election. Aides to Katie Hobbs, who has begun hiring staff to serve her in the governor's office, couched Kerry Lake's far-reaching lawsuit as a nuisance and a sham. Kerry Lake needs attention like a fish needs water, a statement from Katie Hobbs's campaign manager, Nicole DeMont, reads. An independent experts and local election officials for both parties have made clear that this was a safe, secure, and fair election. Arizonans made their voices heard, the statement continued. Katie Hobbs is slated to take office on 2nd of January 2023. The Associated Press has also covered the same story and tells us more. Kerry Lake, the Republican defeated in Arizona's governor's race, is formally challenging her loss to Democrat Katie Hobbs, asking a court to throw out certified election results from the state's most populous county and either declare her the winner or rerun the governor's election in that county. The lawsuit, filed late on Friday, 9th of December, by Kerry Lake, centers on long lines and other difficulties that people experienced while voting on Election Day in Maricopa County, Arizona. The challenge filed in Maricopa County's Superior Court also alleges hundreds of thousands of ballots were illegally cast, but there is no evidence that this is true. Carrie Lake has refused to acknowledge that she lost to Katie Hobbs by more than 17,000 votes. The Donald Trump-endorsed gubernatorial candidate has bombarded Maricopa County with complaints, largely relating to a problem with printers at some voter centers that led to ballots being printed with markings that were too light to be read by the on-site tabulators. Lines backed up in some polling places, fueling Republican suspicions that some supporters were unable to cast a ballot, though there is no evidence it affected the outcome. County officials say everyone was able to vote and all legal ballots were counted. Carrie Lake sued Maricopa County officials and Katie Hobbs in her current role as Arizona's Secretary of State. Sophia Solis, a spokesperson for the Secretary of State's office, said Carrie Lake's lawsuit was being reviewed but had no other comment on the filing. Jason Berry, a Maricopa County spokesperson, declined to comment on Carrie Lake's request to throw out the county's election results in the governor's race. But he said the county respects the election contest process and looks forward to sharing facts about the administration of the 2022 general election and our work to ensure every legal voter had an opportunity to cast their ballot. Katie Hobbs, in a post on her Twitter account, called the lawsuit Lake's latest desperate attempt to undermine our democracy and throw out the will of the voters. She posted a statement from her campaign manager that called the lawsuit a sham and said her camp remained focused on getting ready to hit the ground running on day one of Katie Hobbs' administration. Carrie Lake's lawsuit says Republicans were disproportionately affected by the problems in Maricopa County because they outvoted Democrats on election day 3-1. GOP leaders have urged their voters to wait until election day to vote. In late November, Carrie Lake filed a public records lawsuit demanding Maricopa County hand over documents relating to the election. She was seeking to identify voters who may have had trouble casting a ballot, such as people who checked in at more than one vote center or those who returned a mail ballot and also checked in at a polling place. During the summer, a federal judge also rejected a request by Carrie Lake and Mark Fincham, the defeated Republican candidate for Secretary of State, to require hand counting of all ballots during the November midterm elections. The judge has since sanctioned lawyers representing Carrie Lake and Mark Fincham, saying they made false, misleading and unsupported factual assertions in their lawsuit. The lawyers told the court that their claims were legally sound and supported by strong evidence. Katie Hobbs, in her role as Secretary of State in Arizona, has petitioned the court to begin an automatic statewide recount required by law in three races decided by less than half a percentage point. The race for Attorney General was one of the closest contests in state history, with Democrat Chris Mays leading Republican candidate Abe Hamada by just 510 votes out of a total votes of 2.5 million.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today, we'll listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
In the words of the Ahlul Bayt, in the teachings of the Quran, one of the life practices, one of the secrets to success is bridging this gap between what we need to know and what we do know, and what we do know and what we act upon. We talked about how, you know, the examples of the Jahili poetry, and we said that, you know, this sounds really familiar, this idea of this means of sound and words being used to have appeal to the lowest and the base instincts of human beings. It was there back then and it's there right now. Similarly, this concept of living in a state of doubt, it's something which is described to us in the Quran. Allah Ta'ala in Surah Dukhan, He says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم رب السماوات والأرض وما بينهما إن كنتم موقنين. The reality is that there is one Rabb. There is one entity. There's one being who is in charge. He's the one who is governing. He's the one who is making the laws. He's the one who is the source of all blessings. He's the one who is nurturing you. He's the one who's taking care of you and of everyone in the skies and the earth. But if only you can have certainty in that. Unfortunately, there are those who lack the ability to find certainty in this. They can't arrive at this certainty. They're always in a state of uncertainty. And how are they described? La ilaha illa huwa yuhyi wa yumit. He is the only one who's worthy of being worshipped. He gives life. He gives death. Rabbukum wa rabbu abaikum al-awwalin. He's your Rabb. He's your nurturer. He's your cherisher. He's your Lord. And of those who came before you. But there are people, بَلْهُمْ فِي شَكٍ يَلْعَبُونَ. There are people who are in a permanent state of shak. They satisfy themselves. How? By being in a state of doubting. Oh, I'm not sure about that. I'm going to question that. What do they say? They say that, isn't it arrogant of you to assume that there is something which is true for everyone, that's right for everyone? How can you make such a claim? Everyone is their own individual. Everyone has a voice for themselves. And the Quran calls them out. بَلْهُمْ فِي شَكٍ يَلْعَبُونَ. They're playing around. لَعِب is somebody who's playing a game. That's okay for a child. It's okay for entertainment, but it's not supposed to be a permanent state where we escape from facing reality by putting ourselves into a situation where we can just be playing around. This is something which the Quran described, and it's something which we can see reflecting in our own world, in our own society. Sometimes it's not too hard to find the expression of this in things around us. I'll give you an example. Maybe some people will laugh at this. There's a well-known song that goes with one of the Disney movies, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with, where one of the lines which is, you know, often repeated in that language, many kids have memorized and they say maybe better than the kalima, right? Which is what? It says, let it be. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I just want to be free. Now, if you ponder upon this, no right, no wrong, no rules for me. I want to be free. Maybe it makes us a bit uncomfortable when we start to think about this. That, okay, this is a song. But words are made because of how? Like, why is it that certain words are chosen? Why is it that certain themes are being expressed? Why? Because they are an expression of dominant thought and culture. If it was something that was at odds with the dominant thought and culture, it wouldn't be used in a song that's meant to be popular. And so here you go. There is no right. There is no wrong. There are no rules. I'm a free person. I get to define. I get to construct what's right and what's wrong. I get to construct what's true and what's falsehood. That's a simple example, but let's take it and maybe talk about something a little bit more serious. If you go and look at the issue of Planned Parenthood, for example, right? And you look at, let's say, the Supreme Court's ruling on this topic, Right? What is it that they say? It's very interesting. If you go and look at the words of the Supreme Justice, how he expresses his opinion on this topic. And again, when we talk about these things, I hope that inshallah we can, be thinking and pondering and trying to learn from this. This is reflective of the society that we live in. What does he say? He says, at the heart of liberty, meaning that what does it mean to be truly free in the words of this lawmaking entity? At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. You see how this concept, it's an idea, but how it can turn into a law which is now going to be something which is a very serious issue. That how much right do I have over my own body? How much right do I have over the life of others and what happens to them? This can be defined by what type of philosophical perspective I take on the concept of truth and falsehood. I'll give you another example, which is something that we all need to be very aware about. It's something which is affecting us in many different ways, which is the topic of identity. Because when you start to question, what are the boundaries of right and wrong, and think of it arrogant to say that there is such a thing from before, then if you take that back and you roll it back to the core of it, then it starts to affect the concept of identity. You see it here in the words of the Supreme Justice, that at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence. So does that mean that I get to define my own identity as well? Brothers and sisters, when we look at some of the challenges that our youth are facing, some of the social challenges, some of the areas where perhaps we're losing some of the young members of our community, it goes back to this core concept of identity. And in some cases, the issue goes back to when they were young, when what should have happened is that they should have gotten a correct perspective of who they are, of what their identity is. Who am I? Well, my faith identity, my gender identity, what is expected of me? What are the social norms? What is right and what is wrong? These are the things that are supposed to be ingrained when I'm a child, when I'm young. The Ahlul Bayt, they tell us that your time to teach your child is when they are young. Their heart, Imam Ali says, their heart is like that ground which is ripe to be cultivated. Plant the seeds at that time and then you'll see that they grow firm. But when somebody doesn't have that identity affirmation at the right age, then what happens is that when they face challenges in their life, then things can become very difficult for them.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The fact that football fans in Qatar have spontaneously chosen, without any official instructions or government intervention, to use the Palestinian flag as their symbol of unity speaks volumes about Palestine's position in the collective consciousness. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Mint Press News wrote, "We were mistaken to think that Palestine represents the central issue for all Arabs or Islamic countries. Such language suggests that Palestine is an external subject to be compared to other collective struggles that consume most Arabs everywhere. The ongoing celebration of Palestine and the Palestinian flag at the Qatar World Cup 2022 by millions of Arab fans compels us to rethink our earlier assumptions about the Arab people's relationship with Palestine. Considering the absence of political context to that specific match, clearly, the Moroccans did not see Palestine as a message to be communicated using sports as a platform, but have internalized it to the extent that it became an integral part of their everyday reality. When a group of Moroccan fans were asked why they embraced Palestinian symbols and chants, the question puzzled them. Palestine is in our blood. The love for Palestine runs in our veins, an older man answered, overcome with emotions. Multiple studies have been conducted to gauge Arab public opinion in recent years about the importance of Palestine, most notably the Arab Opinion Index survey conducted by the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies in 2020. This poll found that 85% of respondents opposed normalization with the fabricated regime of Israel. Indeed, the Arab people remain clear in their allegiance to the Palestinian struggle for freedom. No Arab country deviated from this rule from the Arabian Peninsula to North Africa. The Qatar World Cup, however, raises new questions, not about the centrality of Palestine to Arab political consciousness, but whether the representations of Palestine are merely political and whether Palestine is just another issue to be juxtaposed with other urgent Arab issues and causes. Even the Israelis, with their much-touted intelligence agencies, seemed confused and even angry as they rushed to Qatar to report on the World Cup, but also to use the international sports event as a way to translate diplomatic recognition and political normalizations into popular acceptance. However, the two Israeli reporters, Ross Sheknik and Oz Mualim, returned to the occupied territories disappointed. Failing to connect the dots between the Zionist regime's apartheid and military occupation in Palestine, the Yediot Aharonet journalist had reached this convenient conclusion. Despite believing, as open-minded liberals we are, that the conflict with the Arab world is between governments and not the people, Qatar has taught us that hate exists first and foremost in the mind of the man on the street. Not only did the open-minded liberals lack any sense of self-awareness, they, like most Israelis, had completely dismissed the Arab people as political actors capable of thinking and behaving according to their own collective priorities. Moreover, they also confused the Arabs' justifiable anger for the terrible injustices inflicted by Israelis on the Palestinians for random hate that seems to simply reflect the supposed hateful nature of the Arabs. If the two reporters reflected on their own reporting with a truly not self-proclaimed open mind, they would have found some clues. Whenever we report, we are being followed at all times by Palestinians, Iranians, Qataris, Moroccans, Jordanians, Syrians, Egyptians, and Lebanese, all giving us looks full of hate, the Israelis wrote. Considering the deep political divisions that presently exist among Arab nations and Islamic nations, one wonders why ordinary people from vastly diverse Arab and West Asian nations are united in hating the Israeli regime and loving Palestine. The fabricated regime of Israel represents a history of Western imperialism and colonialism, military occupation, racism, violence, political meddling, military interventions, wars, and more wars. Daily images of handsome Palestinian boys and girls killed by Israeli troops, violent Israeli Jewish settlers forcibly expelling Palestinians out of their homes and farms, political arrogance, and much more. Palestinians, on the other hand, represent something else entirely. They embody the unhealed wound of all Arabs. Courage and sacrifice, refusal to surrender, resistance, and hope. The fact that football fans in Qatar have spontaneously chosen, without any official instructions or government intervention, to use the Palestinian flag as their symbol of unity speaks volumes about Palestine's position in the collective consciousness. When Moroccan player Jawad Al-Yamir celebrated his country's national team's victory over Canada on December 1st, thus guaranteeing the advancement of Morocco to the knockout stages of the World Cup, he raised a Palestinian flag. In the background, Moroccan fans were chanting for Palestine and Morocco. For them, Palestine is not an external cause, and their cheers are not simply an act of solidarity. For them, Palestine and Morocco are synonymous, describing the same collective experience of defeat, struggle, and ultimately victory. Middle East Eye also wrote in this regard, Palestine has seen notable support throughout the competitions, especially among those hailing from other Arab nations. Such grassroots support is juxtaposed against the normalization deal signed with the fabricated regime of Israel by Arab countries such as Morocco, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, and others. Hanan Ashrawi, a former Palestinian legislator following the recent win took to Twitter to highlight Palestine's support for the Moroccan team and celebrate its reciprocation, saying that no regime normalization with Israel can break the bond between our peoples. Amro Ali, the West Asian analyst and professor of sociology at the American University in Cairo, echoed Ashrawi's sentiments, calling Palestine the winner in this World Cup. Ali said, Arab regimes can pursue normalization, but the people of the Arab world will have the final say. The Qatar World Cup continues to show the people of the Arab world are not as ready as their leaders to abandon the Palestinian cause and embrace cynical Kushner Netanyahu plans for peace without justice, journalist Robert Mackey tweeted. From refusing interviews with Israeli journalists to chanting songs and waving banners in support of Palestine, fans and players alike have been vocal about their support for the anti-occupation cause at this year's World Cup.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan powers policies and recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. Optimizing of all aspects of the armed forces, including military equipment, weapons, and even ammunition, is one of the important issues that needs to be addressed. The same applies to research and scientific advances, which also play an important role in strengthening the armed forces, as does designing complex hybrid war plans. the wars that are going on in the world today use hybrid warfare. You know hard warfare, soft warfare, intellectual warfare, cultural warfare, war using various weapons, cognitive warfare, and the like. These are all combined together to attack a nation or a country. By the will of God, war games should be able to take care of all these layers with new, up-to-date methods. So, what is the primary responsibility of the armed forces? It is the protection of national security. This is what you, young people, who have just come onto this path, need to be proud of. The armed forces are responsible for the general security of the country. What is the meaning of security? Security is the foundation for all aspects of life in a society. It is a general foundation for personal issues, social issues, public issues, and foreign matters. Security is the foundation of all these things. With regard to personal matters, having security means you can sleep safely in the comfort of your own home during the night.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You can send your children to school in the morning without having to worry. You can commute to your workplace, and you can attend Friday prayers without having to worry about anything. Just look at the countries that worry about these things. They can neither sleep well during the night, nor can they go to work during the day. They cannot freely watch a sporting match, nor can they attend Friday prayers or go on a vacation. And this does not just apply to smaller countries. In big countries, the US being the worst, there is no security in their restaurants. There is no security in their universities. There is no security in the schools that their children attend.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.